Now's the time to rise and shine.
On a Friday, you're with us for the morning show. Rise and Shine from Rafi. Hey, kids. You might know Allie Ward from the Netflix science series called Brainchild. Maybe you've seen her hosting the show called, did I mention, Invention on the CW. Maybe you found her science podcast called Ologies. Regardless, what you need to know is that Allie Ward has, she's up for us. Rise and shine, Allie, and we are with her for the hour to entertain tricky, icky, sticky science questions we throw her way about our planet and beyond. She's also a daytime Emmy Award-winning science correspondent for the Henry Ford Innovation Nation with Mo Rocca on CBS. Allie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. It's I'm in California, so it's super early here, which is really exciting to be up before the sun. I always love that.
That's why we had to play a little Rise and Shine music for you.
I know. I loved it.
Well, let's get started here with your podcast, Ologies. Who is the most important, interesting person you've talked to? Who just blows your mind?
Oh, you know, I've talked to so many great people. One of my favorites, I have to say, which is so, so hard, but I spoke to someone named Dr. Merlin Tuttle, who already out of the gate has such a great name. Merlin Tuttle just wins based on name alone, but he is a chiropterologist.
What?
Which, if you had to guess what that is, what would you say?
Chiro, something with airplanes, chiro, gyro. No, I don't know.
Right? It's tough. It's so fun to break the words down. But so a chiropterologist is, chiro means hand, huh, like a chiropractor, and then pater, like a pterodactyl. So that means hand wing, and he studies bats.
Oh.
So bats are chiropterology because they have hand wings. And he was amazing. He is such an advocate for bats. Bats are our friends and they do great things for us. And he has some great stories about when he has been spelunking in caves over the last 30 years. So he's amazing. I love him.
Wow. Did you go with him at all? Did you see him?
I didn't know. Okay. I didn't, but he had some good stories. You know, I didn't expect to get those kind of like Indiana Jones adventure stories.
Mm-hmm.
I forget that in the field, he's got to strap on a headlamp and go spelunking. He's gotten, you know, caught down the wrong side of caves. He had to make friends with moonshiners in the mountains who, you know, were aware of his work. But he's just such a friend to bats. A lot of times bats get a bad rap, and he's quite the defender of bats. He's down in Austin where there are a ton of cave systems in Austin underground, and that's why they have such a great bat population, because the bats just kind of go wiggle in the caves at night.
Wow. Well, let's get into some questions here to throw at you. Rex is 6 years old and just wrote in by email. Rex has been studying subatomic particles and is wondering if you think the graviton will be discovered and how it would be discovered. Can you explain this at all for us?
First off, Rex, studying subatomic particles at age 6 is amazing. And I don't think I knew what a subatomic particle was at age 6. So, you know, I don't know when the graviton will be actually confirmed. I mean, it's hypothetical at this point. And so, you know, what that means is that scientists are kind of figuring out, well, we have a space for this thing that we think exists, but we can't confirm it. And so that's, you know, of course, when something is still a hypothesis. So the way I think that the graviton might be confirmed is I think Rex is probably going to be the one to figure it out for us. He's 6 and asking those questions. Chances are that when he's a grown-up, he'll probably be the one who's on top of that.
And Rex's mom is also seeking some good sources for science education and exploring advanced topics while still mm-hmm. being kid-friendly. Do you have any tips for that, Allie?
You know, I worked on another show called Brainchild, mm-hmm. which is on Netflix. And Brainchild is great because they have lesson plans. And if you go to brainchildshow.com, they have like downloadable lesson plans that are good for, you know, up to certain grades. So he could always skip a couple grades and use those lesson plans. But yeah, I think libraries are amazing. Asking questions are amazing. And there's even later on today, if he's interested in space and the Hubble telescope, I have a friend who is doing a live stream. So there's a lot of live streams right now I want to find that academy. I'll get back to you, Rex, on that, on the the URL for that. But yeah, there's a lot of really great museums too that have webinars right now that you can kind of join. So I think find an institution that's doing what you love and see when their next webinar is. See if you can ask some questions.
We're talking with Allie Ward. She is a science correspondent. She also hosts the science comedy podcast, Ologies. You can join in with your science questions. They're rocks, earthquakes, butterflies. What do you want to know about? 800-642-1234. We heard from Daryl, who called in, couldn't stay with us, and says, Ologies, your podcast is awesome. You did one on yeast that was really interesting. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah. You know what? I've done two on yeast, I realized. I did zymology, which is the study of beer making. And then I just did, like last week, was gastroegyptology, which is gastro coming from eating in the stomach, and Egyptology. So there was someone named Seamus Blackley, who is out here in LA, and he is amazing. He is a particle physicist. So Rex, definitely going to want to be friends with him in the future, which, by the way, that Hubble telescope webinar I was talking about is Kerbal Space Academy. That happens at 11 o'clock my time. So it happens in about 5 hours, in case anyone wants to hear about that. I have a friend, Summer Ash, who's moderating that. But yes, so yeast are fungus. They're single celled, and they are responsible for the way that our bread tastes and how it rises. And so I spoke with Seamus Blackley about working with archaeologists to get just a few yeast cells from pots that were 4,000 years old.
Wow.
From Egypt, and then kind of worked with microbiologists to culture those yeasts and then baked bread with it. And so the cool thing about yeast is we don't know, kind of like the gravitron, we have no idea how long they can live. They might be immortal, but if they can be resurrected from 4,000 years ago, if anyone out there is baking bread and your starter looks like it's dying, don't worry. If Seamus Blackley can resurrect it from 4,000-year-old pots, like, you'll figure yours out.
Why does the sour taste come into sourdough? How do you make sourdough bread?
Oh, that's such a good question. And so for years, for thousands and thousands of years, bread was sourdough. It just was, because the sour in sourdough comes from a bacteria, a lactobacillus bacteria. That is not a yeast. So the yeast and the lactobacillus work together, and the yeast gives off lactic acid when it eats your flour. And so it gives it that tang and that sour taste, kind of like a yogurt. And so for years, the way that we would get yeast is we would just leave flour and water out, and what would naturally consume that would come and hang out on it and say, thanks so much for the flour. Nom, 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 nom. And what happened about 100 years ago is we started selling yeast from factories. Fleischmann's yeast made a killing, and they made quick rise bread. It would go pretty fast, but sourdough takes, you know, a day or two to really get bubbling. And so our bread became not really sourdough bread, quick fermented. And I think that maybe that's why some people have a harder time digesting certain kinds of bread, but sourdough is easier on your stomach because the yeast and the bacteria have broken down the bread kind of for you before you eat it. So a lot of people who might have, you know, tummy troubles eating bread can hang with sourdough pretty easily.
Science correspondent Allie Ward is breaking down the scientific world, taking us places, indulging our curiosities. You can join in 800-642-1234. By the way, what are you seeing when you get up in your backyard? Is it rabbits? Is it squirrels? What are the cardinals doing? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back with Allie Ward in just a minute here on the Ideas Network.
With the rest of us, shine like a pearl, rise and show your love all around the world. Oh, rise with the bluebird, shine like the sun. Now's the time to rise and shine. Yes, now's the time to rise and shine.
If you're just joining us, we have science nerd Allie Ward here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. She says it's okay to be an adult and be curious. Everyone is curious about something, no matter what your age. And Allie feeds her curiosity with her podcast called Ologies, where she talks to ologists of all kinds, like think astrobiologists, entomologists, volcanologist with those volcanoes. We're asking her science questions all through the hour. What do you want to know about outer space, animals, rocks, earthquakes, butterflies in your stomach, hiccups? Hiccups, not good on the radio. We're at 800-642-1234. And Allie stays with us. Let's take a call now. Janie is joining us from Elkhorn this morning. Hi, Janie.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good drippy morning. I purchased a butterfly house for my granddaughters this past winter. And I would like to know the best source of caterpillars in order for them to watch them develop into butterflies.
Ooh. Oh. Where
First
is
off,
the house?
Yeah, that's amazing. Awesome grandma move.
Yeah.
Well, I'm channeling my own mother. She taught by experience, and we were constantly, I think she just secretly would rather be outside than in the house. But we were always on nature walks and discovering all sorts of fun things.
Oh, Janie, so, thanks.
I do the same for them.
Yeah. Allie, what do we know about butterflies?
Oh, I love butterflies. I interviewed my friend Phil Torres, who is a lepidopterologist, and moths and butterflies, y'all, a lot of people don't realize moths came first and then came flowers and then evolved butterflies in their colorful way to be more daytime dwelling forms of moths. So moths are original. But what I would say, if you've got a butterfly house and you're looking for some citizens and some folks to live in it who are caterpillars, if you've got access to milkweed, I would say plant local milkweed. That is what monarch butterflies love to eat. And we're seeing a little bit of a drop in population with monarch butterflies because their milkweed that they normally eat that isn't as populous because we, you know, have to build houses and malls and we develop the land. And so if you can find the species of local milkweed, just ask your nursery or check online. That is perfect because it's really hardy. It grows easily and you will have so many chubby little monarch butterfly caterpillars. And they're beautiful. They're black and white and yellow striped with these what look like little antennas, which are just these kind of fleshy lobes. But they're awesome. And their chrysalis is beautiful. It's a kind of mint color with gold. So yeah, I would say plant milkweed.
Why do butterflies have such colorful and pretty patterns on their wings?
Oh, that's a great question. And, you know, because they evolved to be more daytime dwelling and rather than moths who are out more at night, they have to blend in with their food sources a lot. And so they need to be on flowers and blend in so that they're not predated by birds. But some, you know, particular types of butterflies like monarchs are, you know how they're that really like bold, spotted and orange? Those are warning colors. Because milkweed is actually a little bit toxic to birds. And so monarch caterpillars are just chowing down. I mean, you should see monarch caterpillars on milkweeds. Wow, they can go to town. They're like me with a box of cereal. They're just like, let's have a little more. And so, but they have a certain toxicity and a bitterness so that when birds eat them, they're like, oh, no, thank you. If you've ever eaten something you don't like, that is how birds feel about monarch butterfly caterpillars. And so those warning colors are saying, hey, you tasted my friend, I'm the same, so watch out. So those colors in nature that are really bold, that stand out and don't blend in, are usually a warning color.
We're talking with Allie Ward. She is a science correspondent for the Henry Ford Innovation Nation with Mo Rocca on CBS. She also hosts a podcast called Ologies and is taking your questions throughout the hour. Talking penguins, butterflies, feathers, emotions. We're going to even talk about number two. Mm-hmm. 800-642-1234. Allie, let's get back into the questions now. We have a question from Brody in Sun Prairie. Wants to know, why do dogs bark?
Oh, that's a great question. Same reason why we're chatting. The same way that Brody asks, why do dogs bark? He's just using his voice to communicate. And so dogs bark to warn each other. They bark to say hello. They bark to tell you they're happy or hungry. And so they bark for so many different reasons, just like we talk for so many different reasons. But most of the time, I think they're mostly, depending on your dog, just asking for belly rubs if your dog is like mine.
Or food. Food is also helpful.
Right, exactly.
There's lots of wiggly teeth out there. I know one of mine is about to, I've got a kiddo with a wiggly tooth. So that has us thinking about teeth. Why do our teeth become loose? Why do we lose them?
Another good, see, these are all good questions. You know, you obviously you have a set of baby teeth that are not quite fitted for what your adult skull is going to be. And in occlusion, which is the way that teeth fit together, are super important. And so one thing I think is just bananas to look at is if you ever look at an x-ray of a child's adult teeth, they're hanging out in your face, like under your bones, and then they're waiting to sort of break down the roots by pushing in and kind of taking over, kind of like if you were your friend was taking a selfie and you just kind of moved in and pushed them out. But yeah, I think it's such a beautiful thing to see how the teeth are in the skull, just kind of waiting in the wings. And so in order for that adult tooth to come in, you have to kind of break the root down so it wiggles and wiggles and wiggles. And then that means that your tooth is just about to come in to that spot, but it's essentially your adult tooth pushing out your baby teeth.
Well, Carson, Carson and Eau Claire, I hope you put some of those teeth under your pillow. Maybe the tooth fairy will come. Let's get to another question, Allie. We have Sophia from Sun Prairie who wants to know, how can some people be so flexible and others are not flexible at all?
Mm. You know, muscles are kind of crazy. Muscles are so cool. So imagine that if you had a bunch of pieces of string, and they were all bundled up, kind of like if you laid out a skein of yarn. So that's what your muscles look like a little bit. They're made of a bunch of fibers that are together. It's not just one hunk. And so these muscle fibers can stretch, and that's what allows you to reach your arm out or whatever. But so your muscle fibers stretch like that. That way you can become flexible. And so some people are flexible because they just stretch them more. And it's kind of like bubblegum. The more you stretch it, the longer it's going to get. And so you can train your muscles to be more flexible by just being consistent with them and stretching those muscle fibers out so that, you know, the next day when you want to stretch them again, they're okay. I'm used to this. I have a little bit more flexibility. And so, but yeah, they're all a bunch of fibers that are together, and some are fast twitch and some are slow twitch, which means that some are good for running short distances really fast and others are good for taking a really long walk.
Well, sometimes our muscles don't like it when we stretch them. Can we overdo it? And what do they tell us when we overdo it?
Oh, you know, when you overdo it, what's happening is it's kind of like if a rope were to fray. And so if you've maybe strained a muscle, what your muscle has to do is essentially do a repair job and say, okay, we got a couple of breaks in here, we got to fix some stuff. And so if you've been working out and your muscles hurt the next day, that is your muscle going, okay, we did a lot of stretching, we used this more than usual, we got a lot of breaks, we got to fix. But which is why a lot of athletes will train hard one day and then rest a day, because your muscle fibers have to go in and do some maintenance. But yeah, or if you strain it too much, you might want to give it a little bit more time and ice it and let it go back down to normal.
Here's a question I just love. Ariana in Sun Prairie is wondering, does a mattress really affect our sleep?
Oh, you know, as someone who had a really terrible mattress for a long time, I can say anecdotally, yes, very much. But, you know, sleep is really interesting because I interviewed a somnologist, Dr. Chris Winters, who's like a guru on sleep. He's amazing. And, you know, what we don't realize is that we wake up a lot during the night naturally. Every time you move when you're asleep, if you're rolling over, you're waking up. And, if you have a mattress that is really uncomfortable and is maybe digging into your back a little bit and it causes you to shift your position, you're actually waking up when that happens. And so everyone wakes up a certain number of times during the night, but if you're, say, doubling or tripling that, you end up losing a good hour or so of sleep just by rolling around. And yeah, that extra hour can definitely affect whether or not you are feeling foggy the next day.
We're chatting with Allie Ward. She's a writer, actress, TV, and podcast host. Most importantly, the proud science nerd. You can see her in the Netflix series Brainchild. So what brainy thing do you want to talk about with Allie? Is there a science experiment or a work of art you're making at home that is highly influenced by science? And when was the last time you made an erupting volcano, by the way? What are the ingredients? Let's talk all things science with Allie, 800-642-1234. Getting a little baby beluga with Rafi here. We'll get back to this after a news update here on the Ideas Network.
Is your mama home with you so happy? Way down yonder where the dolphins play, where you dive and splash all day. Waves rolling and the waves roll out. See the water squirting out of your spout. Baby beluga, oh baby beluga, sing your little song, sing for all your friends we like.
It's the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Just a quick note here that as the coronavirus continues, Wisconsin Public Radio is committed to providing a central source of information at WPR.org/COVID. There you can ask questions. You can see a whole collection of stories from our reporters who are around the state. That's WPR.org/COVID. So right now we're immersed in the world of science with Allie Ward as our fearless leader. She's a writer, actress, TV and podcast host. Most of all, she is a science nerd, card carrying. What is your icky, tricky, sticky questions for Allie about our planet and beyond? Kids, get your parents to lend a hand with dialing. We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. And Allie sticks with us for the hour. Let's bring in another call now. Logan is on the line from Green Bay this morning. Hi, Logan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, man. My question is, is the virus a living thing or non-living thing? From the discussion that we have with doctors, they give me the impression that they're a living thing. And I am confused because the language is so metaphorical. From it, I'm not able to fathom whether it's a living thing or a non-living thing.
Great question, Logan. Yeah, is the virus living or non-living, Allie?
Oh, yeah, that is a good question, because a virus doesn't have much to it other than its, you know, its RNA or its DNA that it infects another cell and kind of makes the cell, turns the cell into almost a factory to reproduce it. And so something that reproduces is considered alive, responding to its environment and consuming energy. So those are the things that make something classified as alive, essentially. And so I think it is kind of tough to look at, you know, consuming energy. If a virus infects a cell that then essentially kind of takes over the cell's mechanisms, does that count as consuming energy? But I think in this case, because it's still able to go out and reproduce, that, yeah, that I think, to my knowledge, viruses are considered alive. But that's a great question, and it's kind of part philosophy and part microbiology, isn't it?
Well, Logan, I hope that helps. Allie, tomorrow is World Penguin Day, and you recently talked to someone who spends all day with penguins. Who is that?
Oh, you know, Dr. Tom Hart is an Oxford research fellow, and he is a world-renowned penguinologist, self-titled. And his lower third, you know, when he goes on news programs, says penguinologist. And he says that he named himself that because it gets people interested in penguins. If you just saw seabird expert, you might not care as much. And so, yeah, he's all, you know, in the field 4 months out of the year in Antarctica and surrounding southern sea islands. And so, yeah, he's been studying penguins for over a decade. He's amazing.
What has he found out about our favorite penguins? What do they do?
You know, they're so fascinating. They're all in the southern hemisphere. And what is really interesting about penguins is they're flightless birds. They're flightless seabirds, but they spend the majority of their time in water. And so when we're seeing them waddling around on land, you know, they're there to reproduce, to, you know, have their eggs and their nests. But when they're in water, they're really kind of like flying in water. So they, they use their wings like flippers, but they are as graceful in the water as a lot of birds that we see in the air. And I think what's really weird also about them is that their knees are in their body. So they have knees, but they're up kind of like, they go all the way up to their ribs essentially. And they have these really, some of them have really long necks, but they're just obscured by feathers and fat. And so when you look at a skeleton of a penguin, they look a lot different than the little, you know, fuzzy potatoes that we see waddling around the ice.
They also give pebble gifts. What are these pebble gifts about?
Oh, they're about being adorable and cute and amazing. But, you know, they have to build these nests a little bit off the ground. That way the meltwater from the ice doesn't make their egg too cold. And so they need to build these little pebble nests. And so they'll sometimes give each other pebbles as gifts to say like, hey, I'm going to be an amazing architect and parent. You can tell because I, you know, combed the beach for this pebble. But sometimes it's portrayed as though they look for one pebble, like an engagement ring. And we've anthropomorphized that. It's not quite that precious. Dr. Tom Hart told me, he said, males and females are both looking for pebbles. They just need a lot of pebbles, but they do sometimes steal each other's pebbles. They're like, oh, it's got some pretty good ones. And then they'll just boop, before you know it, nab someone else's pebbles.
Huh? Wow.
I know.
Well, you know.
Penguin's gonna penguin.
Well, let's move on to another topic. Sometimes it's a little bit gross, but it's poop. You talked with an animal expert who works at a zoo and got to visit her special poo freezers. Let's hear a bit of that.
I saw a freezer that was kind of like a porta potty on Noah's Ark.
This one might be locked, but yeah.
You gotta lock up your poop? One.
Yes, we keep our freezers locked.
So we have black rhino, pygmy hippo, red river hog poo. We have some of our octopus stuff in here. Our giraffe, our black bear, our Japanese macaque, pygmy solorus, diana monkey, eye tamarin, polar bear. That's just what lives in this freezer. Now I have 13 others. We're going to go all around the zoo. We're going to go through each one for you.
Oh my gosh, 13 freezers full of animal poop. Allie, what's going on?
Oh, she is a scatologist, which is a real word. It's someone who studies poop. And, I was so lucky to get to go to the Lincoln Zoo and go check out what their zoologists and endocrinologists are doing. And the reason why there's so much poop on ice in zoos, in particular the zoo, is because it's a lot easier to figure out how an animal's doing in some ways by checking out their poop. And so it's less invasive, rather. So rather than going and taking a blood draw from a tiger, which I don't know about you, would you want to do that?
Yeah, I know.
I'm good. You can pick up their poop and then take it to a lab and figure out, okay, how are their stress hormones? How are they reproductive? How well are they doing on digestion? And so, they keep them as a record. That way they can go back and look and say, okay, well, they're doing, this much better with certain hormones than they were 6 months ago. So yeah, 13 freezers all around the zoo. They just keep buying freezers. She says she's so lucky because they just indulge her poop hoarding, as she calls it. But it's very organized. It's like if Marie Kondo were a scientist. Everything is labeled. It's organized. Like,
oh my goodness. I love it. Yeah. A clearinghouse for poop. And some animals don't really poop at all. Instead, they have these little pellets full of things that they've digested, like animal bones. Tell us about that.
Oh, you know, I think it's so interesting. Owls will take, you know, what they've eaten, say a mammal, and the undigestible parts like the hair and the bones, they'll cough up into a ball. I mean, it looks like like if you cleaned out the lint a reserve in your dryer, and then happen to have a fistful of animal bones. But what I used to love as a shameless nerdy kid is if you'd find a pellet, you could dissect it and then put the bones back together to see what they had eaten. And it's pretty gross, but it's essentially owl vomit, but it's also a really fun afternoon if you're into that kind of thing. But yeah, it was interesting. In scatology, we learned why rabbits, poop like cocoa pebbles and you know, why other animals don't.
Yeah, tell us about rabbit pellet poop. You know, what's in that?
Oh, it's so weird and so fascinating. But certain herbivores will poop in pellets. Like, you know how if you've ever been to like a petting zoo and a goat will just like, instead of doing one big doo-doo, they'll just have a bunch of kind of pellets. Well, herbivores tend to poop that way because usually if they're at a watering hole and they're drinking, that makes them vulnerable to getting eaten. And so they tend to have less water in their systems. Just they've evolved to drink a little bit less. And so that's why they poop in pellets like that. And there's also an interesting thing with, this is so gross, but with rabbits, they have to digest some of their poop twice. And so they have certain poops that will come right out and they'll eat them again. Uh-huh. And they're like, woohoo, it's a snack. And,
is that for nutrition or why are they doing that?
They're called cecotropes, and they are kind of different texture. They're gluier and darker, and their digestive system just needs to break some things down twice. And so it's almost like, why would we put our fruit in a blender before we drink it and drink a smoothie? Rabbits are kind of the same with some of their poop.
They just need second pass. We're talking with Allie Ward. She's a science correspondent for Innovation Nation with Mo Rocca on CBS. She also hosts a science comedy podcast called Ologies, and we're fielding all sorts of questions for her, going all different places, even with SCAT, 800-642-1234. Allie, let's look at birds for a moment. You also had a chat with someone who studies feathers. Why do birds have feathers?
Oh, I think this is so interesting. So feathers are kind of an outgrowth, an adaptation from scales. Isn't that nuts? Mm-hmm. So like if you think of a reptile or maybe you're thinking of a dinosaur, right? They had scales all over their body. And if you think about bird feet, they're scaly as well, right? So birds, which are all living dinosaurs, they started when they were still dinosaurs before they could had evolved flight. They started their scales in some started kind of transforming into hair-like projections. And so feathers are just a really evolved scale that is used for flight. And so I think it's so fascinating. That's why that's why when you see chicken feet, they look more like lizard skin.
Oh, wow. Science geek Allie Ward at our side, taking your questions about our planet and beyond. You can join in. What do you want to know about aliens, by the way? Are you studying to be an astrophysicist? Are you an astrophysicist or a biologist in the flesh? Want to talk about your job? Bring it on, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in 90 seconds. Count them, 1, 2, 3, 4, count them with Allie Ward right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Here's a whoa science fact. Did you know that there's enough DNA in our body to stretch from the sun to Pluto and back 17 times? What is the coolest science fact you know? Dial in 800-642-1234. Your chief science nerd is Allie Ward. She loves to explore and answer questions, ask questions. She hosts the podcast Ologies, and you may have come across her in the Netflix series called Brainchild. She's spending the hour with us. Let's bring in Sam now with a question in Milwaukee. Hi, Sam.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Two little parts of my question, as a lot of other people on the corona nowadays. If I get home and I have the virus somehow on my clothes, and I take off my clothes and throw them in the dryer, does that get rid of the virus? And the other part, if somehow I'm bringing some groceries in the house and somehow the virus got an item in my freezer or in my fridge, does that make it stay longer or does it disappear after a certain time?
Yeah, looking at the resiliency of the virus, whether it goes in the clothes dryer or in the you know, the washer with bleach. What do we know there, Allie?
Oh, that's a great question. I think that they're still really understanding what the effects of humidity and temperature are on this virus. And I think in general, though, what you're doing when you're applying heat or a disinfectant like bleach to the virus is typically breaking down the cell walls of it, which means that it pretty much disintegrates. What I think if it, you know, what I've been doing is if I go out, I just wash and I launder clothes when I've been out, just because soap has that effect to, and bleach in particular has that effect to break down viral walls. And so I did an episode on disinfectiology, which was really interesting in that the reason why bleach works so well to kill viruses and why there's not kind of like an antibody, how you see antibiotic resistant bacteria, it's different with a virus and bleach is because, yeah, it just breaks down those cell walls, which is why using bleach wipes, say, on products before you put them in the freezer or the fridge is can be so helpful. But yeah, I'm not quite sure what the temperature effects are when it comes to cold or extreme heat. But my knowledge of disinfectiology is I tend to use bleach on clothes if I can, and wipes on food products. But I don't know if we know exactly what extreme cold does to it.
Sam, thank you. Yeah, thanks so much for calling, Sam. Let's go to Russ now in Stoughton. Hi, Russ.
Hi. I had a couple of questions. You just referred to birds evolving from the dinosaur age. If there were pterodactyls, why didn't they evolve into birds? And the second question is, how is it that snapping turtles, which I'm told are fairly unchanged from the dinosaur age, how did they survive when the dinosaurs did not?
Ooh. Those are good questions.
Yeah.
I don't know a lot about pterosaurs. I'll be honest. One thing I know about pterodactyls is that they're not dinosaurs. And that if you ask a paleontologist, if you refer to them as dinosaurs, that's the first thing that they do is correct you. So that's pretty much what I know about them. And I don't know why it wasn't a lineage from pterodactyls to dinosaurs. That's my guess would be something about the timelines not working out. I have no idea. But snapping turtles, and what I think is really interesting is there are a lot of creatures that were around before the dinosaurs that are still around. And it may be because like fish survived, you know, the impact crater that killed off the dinosaurs. It might just be because their environments remained more unchanged. So being an aquatic animal or being like a deep burrowing animal might have been a way to kind of escape the peril that the dinosaurs went through because their food sources all kind of disappeared. So yeah, that's why there's like sea creatures that have predated dinosaurs like sharks.
Russ, thank you so much. I don't know how to make a transition here, Allie, but let's talk about kissing. Ew, and so many people are going, ew, kissing. So, you know, what do animals do in terms of kissing, and why do humans kiss?
Oh, you know, I talked to an expert in this, Dr. Robin Dunbar in Oxford, and humans essentially are just smelling each other when we're kissing. We're getting a whiff of someone's immune system and their health. And so kissing is a way to figure out how healthy are you and is your immune system going to be kind of a boon? If we were to have children, would they have a robust immune system? And there are few primates that even kiss. I just talked to a behavioral primatologist essentially who is saying that humans kiss way more than orangutans and chimpanzees. And so, yeah, we kiss to check each other out. Kind of like, you know, what you see dogs doing in the park, they go the other end.
Well, what about the germs? When humans kiss each other, they share germs. Is that good for our immune systems?
You know, I think to a certain extent, yes. I think, you know, obviously, maybe not now. Perhaps now is not a good time to start kissing strangers. But clearly. But, you know, I talked to a really great microbiologist who talked a lot about gut biomes and what is in our stomachs and all of the little critters that live in our stomachs can play a big part in our overall health. And so having a very robust microbiome can actually be really good for you. But yeah, we're certainly exchanging. I forget how many it is, but it's an absolutely staggering number, like something like 80 million or something microbes in a kiss. So something wow. major like that. But evolutionarily, clearly it's been helpful for us.
Well, you better want that kiss then. Well, let's look at fear. You talked to a fearologist, which is another fun word, and you learned that we feel fear a lot of the time.
We're scared all the time. Someone almost spills a Slurpee on your new shirt. No one in the group chat responded to your meme. You have to buy a gift for your sister, but she might not like it. We're scared all the time. We're scared all the time. And it turns out for kind of weird reasons.
Is that really true, Allie?
Well, yeah. You know, every time you are nervous or have you said, you know, to anyone recently that you're anxious about something like a presentation or, you know, a party or something.
Or maybe the pandemic.
The pandemic, yeah, that's all fear. And then you have this little thing that's like an almond-shaped structure in your brain called an amygdala. And we've, on Ologies, we've just started calling it the screaming almond of terror. Because it's this thing that lives in your brain. And essentially, it's responsible for making you feel fear. That way you can use fight or flight, you know, your adrenaline kicks in and all of that, and you can escape a situation if you need to. And that is really handy if you have a bear chasing you, but it might not be so handy if you just, you know, you're nervous about, you know, what your outfit is to a party or something. So yeah, we feel fear a lot. And one thing I think is really interesting is we don't always register it as fear. Sometimes we think that we're angry about something, but really we're afraid. And I think what was really interesting, I talked to Mary Poffenroth, who studies fear. She is a fearologist. And she essentially said that you just have to recognize that you're afraid and ask yourself, what are you actually afraid of? And a lot of times when you unravel it, you'll realize that, you know, if someone hurt your feelings or maybe your partner didn't like the soup you made, what is really happening is you're just afraid that you won't be accepted. Which I think also in a pandemic, a lot of us have very, very real fears. Yeah. And so to just recognize that that's what you're going through and to tell your amygdala, thank you very much. I appreciate what you're doing. Right now I'm safe. I'm at home. Thank you. Well, you know, we can deal with that fear when it comes up again, you know.
Yeah.
In more concrete terms.
Mm-hmm. Allie, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it was such a pleasure to be here. I love Wisconsin. So hello to everyone out there. I've loved every time I've come to visit. Hopefully I'll come back soon.
Oh, we hope. Allie Ward, science correspondent for Innovation Nation on CBS. She hosts Did I Mention Invention? She co-hosts Brainchild, also a science comedy podcast, Ologies. Just ahead, it's On Point. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. We're going to leave it with 1, 2, 3, 4, Feist, Lovin' or Monsters. You're listening to the Ideas Network.
Nothing can compare. Whoa.